Welcome to OS News Podcast, episode number 29, conveniently for the November 29th of November 2009. A lot of nines there. And apologies, we didn't have one last week. I wasn't too good for time, nor was Tom. And Tom isn't joining us today, unfortunately, because he also has a stack of translation work on his desk he needs to do. I'm Croc Cayman, and we're joined today by a previous speaker. It's Tess Flynn.
Hello.
And I'm also beleaguered to say that I'm joined by actual a personal friend who lives in my area that I've known since school, William Hollister.
Hello there.
And where do we start? Okay. We've got 2 weeks worth of news to catch up on, so we're just going to. Oh. Silly me, first of all. Feedback on last week's episode. Me and David discussed all things mobile and the mobile, the state of the mobile industry and where it's going in the future generally. A couple of points that were brought out in the emails received, which are too long to read, and the comments in the article were that, one, we missed out mentioning MIPS because we talked a lot about ARM, and yes, I understand MIPS is like a Chinese design of a chip, and that was kind of what we were getting at anyway. It just literally skipped my mind, that was all. It's you can know everything in the world, and as soon as you put a microphone in front of someone, they forget everything. And the exact same situation was with MAMO as well. Because we went on a lot about Android as opposed to iPhone versus Android. We didn't mention all the other platforms like MAMO, was the one with GNOME, a Clutter, and Moblin, that's it, Moblin. Not that I was downplaying them at all. Whenever I said Android in that program, I meant generally this, you know, the whole lot bunched together, Android, MAMO, all of these mobile platforms for what they represent. And here in the UK, I don't really have access to those kinds of devices like MAMO. I've never used a MAMO device. I haven't even seen a MAMO device on sale here, like the Nokia N800 and N900. And I'm sure they're available to get hold of, but very, very, very pricey in UK pounds. So I apologise for the ignorance in that case, but I don't think that we intended to miss them out, and I don't think that not saying them meant any less in actual the precepts of what we're saying about the future. So, anyway.
This makes me wonder if there's a rule for podcasts, just like there's a rule for television. If a video camera adds 10 pounds to you, does a podcast microphone reduce your IQ by 5 points?
5 points is probably an underestimate, I'd go there, Tess. Standing in front of a crowd tends to drop my points by about 10, so I think this is, I'm probably working at about 70 at the moment.
Just scraped together some noise, yes. Where are we going to start here? After last week's episode, we've got a lot of noise coming from everywhere, but I think, actually, the first big announcement since last week, going in reverse order, is Chrome OS. I think it's unavoidable to avoid discussing that, because it's such a, well, it's such a big thing. It is for me, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know. Chrome OS came across as a really big anti-climax to me, because with all of this hype and all of the speculation that we've been following in the internet media for months now on what is Chrome OS, it's going to be great, it's going to do stuff, or it's not going to do anything, and then we find out, oh, it's just a Chrome browser.
That's
on top
exactly
of
it. That's exactly what I was expecting. For some reason, I was not surprised at all, actually. I think it was exactly what I imagined it to be. Basically, the Chrome web browser with no operating system Chrome to speak of, just a web browser. That's I think any hype there was misinterpretation or jealousy by the community. I think there was the announcement was important and special in a way because one, this is Google entering the consumer operating system space. That in any form can't be downplayed as to the significance of that. Google entering a new market,
but they've already done that. I mean, they did that through Android through a very similar process. And while Android is doing pretty well right now, it didn't destroy the entire market share as we know it. It merely went after a very particular niche and did surprisingly well, given all of the factors that it had against it from the beginning.
But Chrome OS...
I was just going to say, chiming in my bit, I'm actually along the same lines as Tess. When I heard that Google, the monolith that that is, was going to be tackling the OS situation, you expected them to bring their same kind of UI flair of simplicity into things. I just didn't quite appreciate how simple they were going to make it. I didn't think that they were just going to rely on the Chrome browser. You're like, okay, it's good. And if nothing else,
they made a glorified netbook OS. That's what they did.
Yeah, but
and it's not even that impressive of a netbook OS because you are completely, utterly restricted to the browser. You can't have any client-side applications that don't go through a browser. And there are other netbook OSs out there which allow you to at least run things like OpenOffice. I mean, really, guys? This is the strategy you're going to go through?
You can't Brock,
are you thinking of our home users?
Pardon?
Are you thinking of home users at this point? Because that's the main advantage I'm seeing to the Google OS.
You cannot build Mountain in one go. You cannot build everything in one go. You have to be able to leave room for everybody else to develop. And this is and Google were very clear up front that Chrome OS is specifically written for particular netbooks and nothing else. They're not even thinking about the desktop computers at this moment. So they set their sights on something specific, on netbooks that have an operating system that people mostly use as an internet browsing device, which is a companion to other computers. You will have computers that can do OpenOffice, and you will have computers that can do Skype and so forth, but this is something that you're using for 95% of your web browsing. So they targeted a core audience that gives them a valid market. It doesn't have to run OpenOffice. There's Google Docs for this, any holes that the operating system has in functionality, people will be able to fill in with web apps eventually.
But that really assumes that individuals are actually the market shares savvy enough to understand that a netbook is going to be an inherently restricted device, and that while it might look like a laptop and quack like a laptop, it doesn't have a CD like a laptop and means that you can't do anything else that's outside of a browser? That
I just say
seems
this is
to
a
be a bit
market.
Of a leap for me to see that a lot of consumers are going to take that angle. It just seems a little bit too much.
I wouldn't say a lot of consumers. I don't know what Croc's thinking on these lines, but I'm just casting my mind back to certain customers I come across where I do have to go into explaining what the right mouse button does and what the left mouse button does. And for these people, the only thing they'll know is the web.
Yeah,
so to give them a laptop and go, it's the web.
I had a mainframe user, which was actually the same way.
Me and David were discussing, mentioning in the previous show about devices and saying that if you can create a laptop that is just a good web browser, then people can see that as a good web browser and know what to do with it. But if you can create a computer that says this can do anything in the world, they are so utterly mesmerized by the fact that it can do anything, they have no clue what to actually do with it. And so it doesn't matter that it can't do other things, because to a consumer, they're not aware that a computer can do other things until they're shown that it can do it. So if it browses the web, that's basically mostly what they need. And you can say things like, you don't need an antivirus, because the system is secure by design and doesn't need an antivirus anyway. And just show how fast the machine is, because that's what matters to a consumer, speed. You turn it, you have two computers that are next to each other, and one takes 45 seconds to start up, and one takes 10 seconds. Now, you can ignore all the technical aspects as to why that is. They don't care. They just see that one is faster than the other.
And the other argument that a lot of people have thrown that way is, good luck playing a DVD on it. that kind of thing where you're saying, trying to put multimedia onto your netbook. I'd say that there's so many devices out there that are catering specifically to multimedia. Like, the Xbox is now starting to be this multimedia unit. You've got the Wii starting to get in on the internet streaming thing with the BBC iPlayer and all the rest of these things. But it's just most people nowadays outside of the techie world aren't going to set themselves up in an HTPC. They're not going to make this kind of media center connected to their telly. And I just don't think Google Chrome is targeted at anyone on this podcast.
Yeah, that's the most difficult thing about talking about this, is that we're all geeks and we are therefore, by nature, void from this discussion.
Quick, I'll go find my wife, hold on.
Yeah, I think this is Chrome OS is the future. Unquestionably, I think it is the long-term future. Everything is moving to the web, even if we don't like it, even if it's stupid to do so. Everything is moving to the web. It's the same reason why we have this horrible, disgusting, unwieldy, insecure forum software instead of still using Usenet. It's why we have these, you know, doing chat applications on the web instead of just using IRC, which has been around for long enough and is perfectly good. We're moving everything to the web, even if it doesn't make sense to do so, because the web affords us something that has never been possible before, which is that you can sit down at any computer and you can have your application there.
I'd say, even Tess, you've got to appreciate this from your standpoint. If you're constantly having to migrate around the world, the idea of just grabbing anyone's computer and saying, there's all my documents, there's all of my, oh, the big one for me, bookmarks. Oh, I know that there's various applications that migrate the bookmarks around, but actually having clustered bookmarks, because I will have you a lot of web comics, and I tend to just have open these 30 bookmarks and quickly work my way through them. The idea of having your entire user experience migrating with you is the main reason I see everybody moving onto the web. It's just that idea of cloud, and the web is the biggest cloud that people can come up with.
I admit that is actually a killer app. There's only one problem, and being in the US, this one is a far more acute problem than you might experience in Europe, which is the pervasiveness of access.
Mm.
The ability to actually get to the network is not as easy as people think it is. In a lot of the travels that I do, I actually have to specifically ask my clients, will I have a unfettered access to the internet? And sometimes I don't have it. They actually lock me completely out of it. And I'm forced to go through my phone through an edge connection very, very slowly to get anything done. It's incredibly frustrating. The pervasiveness of access is very different when you take in different nations and geographical distributions. And I think that's Chrome's Achilles heel. Chrome OS's Achilles heel is the pervasiveness of access. And in the US, there are places where you cannot get access, period, to save your life.
Well, it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, is that the only way we're going to solve this problem with horrible companies like AT&T is to force them to upgrade their thing. AT&T have been caught short with the iPhone, where people have actually, for the first time ever, started to use the internet on these phones, you know, that they've been paying for so long. And AT&T are all suddenly surprised by this fact. And have been caught out with insufficient network capability, and it's forcing them to upgrade, and it's also forcing greater competition, which will push this up. I think Google Chrome OS might help towards that as well, because I mean, here in the UK, it's not actually that bad a situation. 3G is pretty expensive, but availability is 92% to 99%. Lit tumbleweed.
Sorry. there was quite a bit of dropping out on that, but I caught most of what was being said, and I kind of agree hugely. The idea of saying we've got to get companies like AT&T to insert any action is it's not a legitimate argument.
No, it's not. Telecommunication companies have the wonderful irony of being really advanced on one hand and terribly backward on the other hand. It just seems to be the nature of them. And either it's due to internal policies, or they're spending so much time trying to push higher tech out to the consumers that sometimes their internal processes suffer. We see this in a lot of different organizations here in the U.S. You see it in Comcast. You see it with AT&T. You see it with a lot of different organizations. They fail to grasp what's really going on in some cases.
Well, one thing I was going to say about Chrome OS is that it's better that it's web applications than it is an app store, because one route that they could have taken with this is to do everything approved.
Well, it is an app as well. I mean, it's the Chrome browser. It's just put on top of a Linux stack. I can do that myself.
But, I mean, the web apps you use are anything you choose. You can put in any URL and get to any website you want, whereas Apple are
That opens up a whole huge list of privacy concerns and licensing concerns. And that, I think, a lot of users are only beginning to become aware of those privacy concerns. And we're seeing that even in European politics right now with the Pirate Party.
But wouldn't you argue that that really is only talking about the more advanced user base and the corporate world? For the average Joe, there's not really that much of a concern towards privacy or anyone even acknowledging that Google Apps might be an insecure way of storing your personal documents.
It's unfortunately the new generation of kids have no concept of privacy. I have not seen any kid who gives a toss about what company stores what information about them as long as
Facebook.
They can access their stuff. And our perceptions of privacy are going to fundamentally change in a short period of time. We have grown up in a time before the World Wide Web. I grew up when there was no World Wide Web, and you were used to applications coming on CDs and being on a computer and everything you worked on that computer. There was none of this network transparency. Now web apps are a new thing that we're getting used to. Kids are now growing up, and they have Hotmail and they have Gmail. If I wanted to read my email, I used to have to cycle to school to do so. And yeah, that's the difference, is that these concepts of privacy, unfortunately, as scary as it is, as how much abuse these companies are going to have with people's privacy, is going to be the norm. That's just going to be the way it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day,
does that really reflect better, reflect on Chrome actually being in a position to rise to ascendancy or not?
Should Google really be the gatekeepers of the internet? Should they say this website is good and this website is not good, and say what people should and shouldn't be allowed to do on the internet? That's what Apple are doing with the App Store, and it's been an utter unmitigated disaster for them.
I wouldn't go that far, but yeah.
Well, I mean, we can get into a huge long argument about gatekeepers of the internet with telecommunication companies here trying to do deep packet inspection. You have the Australian government with its ridiculous filtering scheme and on and on and on and on. But I think that gets a little from the point.
Okay, perhaps then we should, unless we've got anything else to add to that, we should move on. Because I think this is only an announcement of Chrome OS. It's not the actual product. Whilst we've managed to get images of it, you can't really do much of it at the moment, and it's going to be a year before we actually see the devices. And I think this is an operating system that is specifically designed for a device as a whole, like an iPhone. You don't go running an iPhone OS on any particular computer you want. It's all part of the whole hardware package, and that's what Google are aiming for with the netbooks that they are planning, that it's going to be an integrated hardware and software experience. I think that will play a part of its success as well, ultimately.
But how will that mesh with Android? I mean, that's a completely different line that could compete in a relatively similar sphere.
I was going to say about Android and Chrome OS, the reason that they exist as two separate entities is simply because of input. Android is an operating system designed around handsets, where you use, you know, a handset keyboard or navigation to move it. Chrome OS, they have specifically designed for a network, for a standard full-size keyboard. And I think that's basically where the difference lies. Where they've been cramming Android onto netbooks and these ARM-based networks, etc., it's a bit clunky because it's not an operating system that was designed for a desktop or a computer.
No, of course not. I mean, Android x86, if you've ever taken a spin of the live CD of that, you'll notice that in 5 minutes that the UI just does not scale to larger resolutions.
No, exactly, that's it. Google have said that they think over time things will merge, but that's only to say when it happens. But I think that's basically the idea of why Chrome OS exists, and they're not just using Android. Because this is about experience. Google are not going to just ship a crappy experience and expect the user to pick up and deal with it, like with Linux desktops. They want to ship an extremely streamlined and well-managed experience, like the iPhone.
I mean, if you want to rag on crappy user experiences, I mean, you can go after Microsoft for all it's worth. There are Linux distros
which don't
care, and there are some which care very, very much. It's important to make that distinction.
I think the one thing that Android has brought into the foremind of people, and the one thing that Chrome OS might do as well, is having an identity that moves across different platforms. I mean, one of the main things I'm loving about my iPhone at the moment is that I can have everything going through the little Exchange pack for Google and actually carry my identity around with me, jump onto other computers, and just have me there. And I'm not even sure if Chrome OS is actually going to be the one that fills in the that little spot in the market, but anyone who's bringing that to the forefront and anyone who's trying to push new ideas into the public mindset with the clout that the Google name has is no bad idea, because at the moment people still think it's a two-man race, Mac or Windows.
Yeah, that's one thing that's got to change, and I think that this standard desktop paradigm is going to decline, not disappear, but decline, because most people are just doing web browsing as their main work, and that's going to increase as more and more web apps get ported to the web, and that we are now accessing the web through many different kinds of devices. So desktops, I think, will start to move away down to the more Hollywood work when you're doing video editing and stuff that requires the power. But the web will just become, your devices will just become a viewport into the internet, just a hole that pokes through to the internet. And so it doesn't matter what device you are using, you're all accessing the same thing.
Aren't we getting, in that case, aren't we looking at a race to the lower middle, as it were? We have Android from the handset devices rising up, and you have the netbook devices trying to push the desktop and handheld devices on both fronts. And the question is, how long will the netbook form factor actually succeed as handheld devices become that much more advanced and that's much more capable?
I'd say it's already blessed.
I think smaller and more portable tends to win out in the end. I think that eventually handhelds will probably still succeed as the primary day-to-day carry-with-me-always platform, and netbooks are really going to be a passing phase.
Yes, netbooks, I think, so far, no one has released an actual netbook. I think they've just released small factor laptops. The key to what truly makes a netbook, I think, and we'll see a new age of netbooks, or a new sort of refreshing of the idea, is when we get ubiquitous networking on netbooks as common as standard, and that the form factor moves over to ARM, so that we have incredible battery life, and we have it very thin, very cool, and I think netbooks are going to increase in size, and they're going to then eat into the current laptop space, which people are basically...
Well, they already are.
Yeah. I'm saying in a sense that laptops have now replaced desktop computers, but I think that netbooks are going to increase in size, and because of the move, because of potentially using ARM or just improvements in technology in general, that these netbooks, which are completely web-based, are going to serve most people's needs for what they're currently using a laptop for, a glorified internet box.
See, I think that the one thing we have to remember here is that the whole game is going to change when the iTablet is released. And at that point...
Oh, not that.
I honestly, to be truthful here, everybody knows iTablet.
Show me something that's not a Photoshop, and maybe I'll consider it. Right now, it's speculation.
It's such bull, but... Oh, it is so much less than speculation. It's just bull. But the one thing I have noticed is that the netbook people, you start looking at some of the new models, they're starting to make the convertible tablets. Everybody is already realizing that the iPhone's format, love or hate the operating system and the way that they are guard-dogging the entire thing, the iPhone's format is a brilliant example of design, UI, and usability. Even that god-awful keyboard has become second nature to me. And I think that that's what might happen.
I'll have to give that to you, yeah.
iTablet for the win.
Yeah, what was that? William, have you listened to episode number 20, I think it is, the Apple show yet?
Oh, no, I haven't. I haven't. I'm catching up at the moment.
Okay, we go into the whole tablet thing a lot there. And it was just last week that David also mentioned that basically the iPhone is a tablet. It's just a small tablet. Yeah. It is a tablet device. We just don't
completely
think of it as a tablet.
And that's why it's just got to get bigger, like Tess said.
Yeah. But I just don't think the usability is there. You use the iPhone because it could be used with one thumb and it fits in your pocket. But you know, are you getting like a 7 to 9 inch device that doesn't fit in your pocket? Are you really going to want to use your thumbs when they don't fill the whole screen? And it's painful to do so. Some people are going to want a proper keyboard, which is where the netbooks fill in. It's hard to say.
Not tumbleweed, I'm getting lots of lag here, but I'd say, users still like the UI. Users still like having a tactile interface. You can't get away from that. But I think what you can do is change to what people think. Yeah, we like a tactile interface because we've had a tactile interface before. But if people get used to the idea of just gesturing and having a HID that constantly changes with each application, people are going to be okay with it. People will move forward, and I think that at the end of the day, it will just become the norm. People are going to move towards the screen and on-screen keyboards because it provides so much more flexibility for the end user and for the programmer.
On-screen keyboards really need to have a complete rethought in the UI department anyways. They seem almost an afterthought in every touchscreen-oriented OS I've ever tried. It's like, come on, guys, put some thought into this.
Yeah, but isn't that also just, again, people trying to shoehorn desktop operating systems into mobile devices, into the web? And this is where I think, again, Chrome OS is doing something interesting in that it is not trying to be a desktop OS. It doesn't try and shoehorn the web, the desktop into the web. It just assumes the web and does everything that way by eschewing native applications. So the experience is better for it, and the same needs to be done of a touchscreen device, which is why the iPhone is so successful, because it isn't Windows Mobile.
I'd agree. To a large extent, that's, yeah, exactly. I agree. I completely agree. It's just targeting a very small demographic and doing it well.
That's all they need to do. They don't need to beat Microsoft with their first product. I mean, good grief. You know, our geek's so pent up that we must see Microsoft be destroyed or Apple be destroyed before we're happy. We want diversity, and if this is going to add to it, then all the better.
Well, I also have to point out that the destroy Microsoft, the huge juggernaut at all costs, is really kind of a consumer PC perspective on the world. You go into the enterprise world and, yeah, you only see Microsoft on desktops. You don't see them actually doing work. The real work gets done on mainframes and Unix systems and systems that most people don't even know exist.
Yeah.
Let us move on to our next topic.
Yes.
We could have some fun about this. I don't know. Microsoft to pay content providers to de-index from Google.
Oh, yeah. Not that they'd ever do underhanded things like that. I mean, it's purely speculation, right?
Oh, gosh.
Well, what do you expect? I mean, Microsoft is a business, and they're working as a business.
It's almost like Microsoft sees an opportunity to kind of buy their way into a market and are doing it, which is a completely novel approach for Microsoft on this point. I mean,
when in doubt, buy them out. It just, oh gosh.
Right and true. It works. It works.
It reeks of business 101. I mean, yes, it works, but oh my days. It's just, you want to bang your head against the desk because Microsoft just do not get it. They simply don't understand the web. Everything they try fails with the web, and everything they try is just repulsive almost.
Oh, just trying to log out of Hotmail is a painful experience. That's not.
No, even worse, have you ever logged into Live and looked at your profile in Live and tried to set all the privacy options in Live? It's, oh my days, wow. I mean, as far as writing awful, overcomplicated, insane code and apps, then, well, Microsoft take the biscuit.
Yeah.
But again, this is also similar. The reason I mention this is because it's also similar to the news that Rupert Murdoch wants to delist his stuff from Google. Where actually the actual truth is that he actually wants to get Google to pay him for his content, because he could just add one line to his robots.txt and delist it straight away. We don't need a news item for that.
Which, well, he just wants money.
Yeah, that's the thing. Which, of course, he could do
this
with one
line. This is just
line.
Like the AP News, then, who wants to sue people for linking to their articles without paying them royalties. I mean, come on, guys. Old media, new media, could we just get along here?
Well, saying that, you then got people like the New York Times, who are really, really progressive on these things and are moving forward into new media. So it just seems like there's a small, very vocal minority who just make these wonderful, wonderful news articles.
Yeah, again, it's old media, new media sort of thing. And that's why I think that this Microsoft thing is just an old media way of doing things. We'll just throw money at them. That will make our product better. I mean, let's not actually improve the search capabilities of Bing. Why don't we just pay people to not be on Google? It's and the brand hammer that they've come down with on Bing, every single search box in every Microsoft application, in every Microsoft website, has all been changed to Bing.
Oh, but they're looking at quantity over quality again. They're doing the same thing that they've done in the iOS, quantity over quality. Let's plow in as much as we possibly can. And they think that by having the most content on the web, they're going to be able to take market share away from Google. One of the main reasons why people like using Google is you go to that website, the only thing that's there is a text box and a button. Love it. That's what I want when
you
I want to search the web.
You can't get past the sheer simplicity of the Google search page. Even today, it is a thing of beauty to see nothing but functionality staring at you right in the face.
Yeah, the Bing page is perfectly fine. I mean, I'm looking at it now, but I mean, it's just a very graphical, but nonetheless, it's the same thing, a text box and a search. But
yeah, it is.
But the
so. It somehow feels cluttered.
It does, and the logo is awful, and also just the general results are not fantastic. At the end of the day, a search engine lives and dies by, you know, what results it's able to give.
I'd also say for the geek community.
Eddie.
I was going to say, for the geek community as well, I think that you aren't ever going to have Microsoft win out in this one. There's so many reasons. The fact that with the Google search box, it's no longer just putting the words that you think are going to be on the page. It's using quotation marks and the minus in order to restrict out results. It's the fact that it's become a verb. Okay, average people tell me to Google things. It's not a verb in the English language yet, but I'm sure it's going to be in the next iteration.
It was canonized a while ago.
It's me being behind on my linguistics, but
again,
it's a verb. How do you compete with that?
You can't really. And the worst example I've ever heard of was Amazon search engine, A9.com. Do you remember that?
God, no.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Right,
I've never used it.
Yeah, so Amazon created their own search engine called A9.com, and then they paid a lot of money to have this product placed in, I think it was the OC, and someone actually said, yeah, I just A9.com'd it. No word of a lie.
That's awful.
So this is the same approach. If you just pay people enough money, they will use your product.
But it's not working. It's not going to get that kind of same market penetration now. I just think that it's a failed attempt on the first part for Microsoft, but all power to them. They're going to keep trying. They're going to keep trying to expand out their empire as much as possible. And if you didn't have Microsoft as a yardstick for what not to do, then how would you measure all of these other approaches, you know?
Yes, Google so far haven't done anything majorly wrong. I mean, you can certainly find fault for them for privacy or whatever qualm you've got against them, but as far as effectiveness of their products, they're doing a good job. If Google make a massive, great, big blunder or something, I wonder when it is we're going to see that.
Agreed. They need to screw up before they can be dethroned.
I mean, Microsoft's playing the defensive with this case, isn't it? Aren't they? I mean, they're not the juggernaut in this particular market, and it's got to cause a huge amount of cognitive dissonance for them to try to conceive of, how do we take this other person who absolutely has this market share locked up, how do we take them down? And Bing seems to be, well, we'll try to imitate them, and it's not working all that well. Sorry, guys.
This is, again, the understanding that Microsoft do not understand the web. Never have, never will. Everything they try seems to be imitation and just catching up. And they write awful web apps, and they write awful interfaces on the web, and they have the worst browser there is. It just seems to be a failure to understand the way in which you operate on the web.
Yeah, but you're trying to argue that Microsoft doesn't have an idea of how users use things.
Not,
I should probably
users
argue
do things. They don't have an idea of the personality of the World Wide Web, how you do things on the internet, how things you get things done, what constitutes as good, right, and what's wrong on the World Wide Web. They just I don't know. They treat the web like Windows, like a proprietary desktop operating system, and they do things in a way that just completely clashes. It's against the grain, as it were, of how you do things on the web.
Could you reduce it down to Microsoft doesn't get open? They just don't get it. The idea of we're going to make it so that other people can make money and help themselves, it just doesn't sit well with their ethics. And as you say, it makes for a user interface that is just painful. I've stopped using Hotmail altogether. It was my first email service. I won't use it now because it is a really great security hole. It is a horrible, horrible user experience. But moreover, there's just nothing extra there. They haven't brought on board Google's idea of having the calendar as an accessible thing that can be easily beamed down onto any of your netbooks or integrated with devices. And you can't even get Hotmail onto your email client unless you're using one of the newer operating systems, where they started to allow you to use a standard free Hotmail account on an email client. That's backwards. It just constantly trying to lock out their own user base.
Yeah, they're still on a proprietary drive of trying to lock people in. Like, you have to download Windows Live Mail or the Windows Live Suite to use a Hotmail address inside an actual email client. And then, annoyingly, every single time Windows Live updates itself, it tries to install 7 other programs on your computer, which I have to constantly fight against. They just bludgeon users with their brand. I hate it. It's so repulsive.
The idea of constantly piggybacking all of their other bad ideas onto the one thing that you'd actually like is probably that's my biggest bugbear.
Because we're just bragging on Microsoft, that's cheap.
Sorry to the user base lag causing some concerns with the flow and pacing of this.
Yeah, I will edit out the blank spaces, but we're struggling with the flow here. Let's get on to something different. Tess, you'll be better in knowledgeable here. Ubuntu dumps GIMP. It really needs a paint.net.
Well, okay, so really the underlying problem here is that the Linux platform doesn't really have a casual, everyday photo editor that is not tied to a big corporation. I think there is Picasa for Linux out there somewhere, but there isn't one that's truly a easy-to-use editing graphic piece of software that has enough power for casual users who have pictures and want to eliminate red eye and do things of that nature. And GIMP, let's face it, GIMP is an advanced tool, and it always has been an advanced tool because that's how it's put together. Trying to explain this to even my coworkers, what a layer is in this piece of software, it causes them just to stare at me like, what? So Ubuntu really does, the Linux platform as a whole really needs a truly open source, easy to use, casual photo editor. And everyone usually says, well, we have GIMP. It does everything. But no one says, well, but that's too complicated. That's a subtlety that sometimes gets lost within the open source developers community because we think we have a solution and it's a better solution because it does all this other stuff. But there's always the problem of, well, is that too much? And
so
paint.net won't work because it's tied to .NET. .NET does not run on Linux, and I know there's Mono, but Mono does not have Windows forms, which I can almost guess paint.net uses extensively. So, no, not going to happen.
It's also just the UI thing. It's not that GIMP can't be usable for those sorts of things. It just doesn't have the UI for it. And I think the Linux...
It has a professional, it has a graphic professional UI. That's how it's designed and that's who it's geared towards. And once you get into that mindset, you can work with that product very, very, very quickly. But when you try to have a new user who just wants to do a simple thing, they just get UI overload. They don't know what to do.
Yeah, I think that open source world is too hung up on creating a Photoshop killer or just copying Photoshop, just imitating Photoshop. It seems to be, because it's the measure by everybody, the standard by which everybody measures a graphics program, is it as good as Photoshop or can I replace Photoshop with it? We're missing the point here. I think Photoshop is an absolutely awful program. Why you'd want to copy it, I don't know. It has mentally retarded UI paradigms in it. Adobe's bugs and failures in it are epic. It's just an awful piece of software, but it's the standard. It's once you learn, you know, once it's beaten you enough, you learn to love it.
I like that you compared this to spousal abuse, but the idea of saying that Photoshop is awful UI, I can see where you're coming from in the fact that there's just too much out there in your face when you don't need it. But
it's not that Photoshop is a bad UI. It's that everybody else tries to be Photoshop. That's the problem. Everybody is trying to be Photoshop. And I think Photoshop, as a paradigm, does things in a particular way that we shouldn't copy, and we should try other things as well. I use PaintShop Pro primarily, and I think it is a wonderful UI. It has its flaws, but the paradigm is interesting and different, and I get on with it well. It doesn't
well, how
try
is
to
it
be Photoshop.
That? How is it different?
It's more. It is a Windows program. I run it in Parallels, but it is a Windows program. It tries to be like a Windows program. It integrates nicely. The menus are ordered in a sensible way. It's hard to describe because it is such a subtle thing about it, and design is something that's very hard to explain without getting on and actually using the tool. And I just think that that Photoshop just proves incredibly difficult until the point that you've learnt it, whereas something like PaintShop Pro, it starts off easier and gets as difficult as you want to make it.
Are you just talking about the way that the UI is organized, or underlying
organized
theory by which the graphic,
yes,
in which you interact with how you create the graphics?
Yes.
Because,
exactly.
I mean, the layers concept has been around in professional graphics editors since, well, before I actually started doing any graphic editing myself. So if it's not different from that fundamental concept, I have a hard time trying to wrap my head around how different.
In PaintShop Pro, you can create layers that are either vector or raster. So you can have as many layers as you want in your document, and you can create vectors anywhere, and then have another layer on top of that, which is raster, which you can paint on and everything like that. And that's immensely useful for me because I can lay out a web design almost entirely in vector, and then just create extra raster graphics for special effects and for raster images and for drop shadows and things like that. Whereas in PaintShop Pro, everything is raster, and the path tool and things like that are just very unwieldy if you want to modify and update them and things like that, whereas I can freely switch between layers that are vector where I need vectors and raster where I need rasters.
That makes sense.
The question though is that does that actually correspond with a larger market share, because raster individuals hardly have any use for vector tech. I mean, a lot of the graphic artwork that I do, I mean, it all comes from a tablet, and I hardly ever use more than three or four paths just to get a straight line that I need it somewhere on the screen.
Yeah, but it varies for everybody. I use almost 99% vectors for the work that I do. In fact, I've created whole pieces of artwork that are just
entirely
vector. Then
why don't you use Inkscape then? I mean, that's 100% vector.
Yeah, because on OS X it looks like an arse.
Oh.
The UI is awful. It's as bad as GIMP. It's just unusable. It basically offends me. I would rather run Windows and use a program that looks and works in Windows as it should than use a program on OS X that isn't an OS X program.
Wow, how bad is Ink that you actually would rather run Windows? That's pretty horrific for you. I've known you for a while, and for you to say that sentence,
I'm so petty. I really am. I really am. But UI just irks me. If something is out of place, oh, it just it's nails on a chalkboard to me. So native stuff is important to me.
I thought that multiple mode layers was actually going to be one of the features they were going to put into GIMP. I thought I saw that in one of their timelines somewhere.
I don't know. Unfortunately, I don't follow it because, again, it's not even though it's free. It's not something I would run on Windows because A, you got to install GTK Plus, and I don't want to install stuff on Windows I don't want.
No. Just wait a minute here. I mean, when was the last time you installed GIMP on Windows?
Probably within this year.
Okay. Now, the installation process on Windows is not something that I really care too much about because GTK gets automatically installed with it with the standard installer. It's almost transparent to the user. And anyone who is a casual user or a graphic artist who will prefer to use a free and open source tool instead of ripping off Photoshop from a torrent will probably not care about the few megabytes of space that it's going to take compared to the behemoth that is Photoshop.
That's true. I'm probably going to get a load of complaints about my comments anyway. I know that. In fact, I'm not going to apologize for them. I'm just going to apologize for the fact that I'm not so well articulate in how I express my opinion, but I'm not changing my opinion.
And I have to admit that I actually haven't used Photoshop in probably 5 years now, because as soon as I found GIMP, I went completely with that.
Yeah, I'm not saying that GIMP can't do what you needs to be done. I just think that it tries to be Photoshop too hard, and therefore it's unwieldy as far as I know. If you already use Photoshop before, then if someone's made a customized GIMP shop, which is every bit as like as Photoshop as it can be.
I don't know exactly if that's the case. I mean, in Photoshop 5 and 6, it actually was a lot closer to GIMP's current UI, but when Photoshop CS came about, the UI changed so drastically that the two programs didn't feel the same anymore at all. And while both programs do tend to go after the same concepts, I don't think that this is necessarily GIMP trying to be Photoshop as GIMP trying to follow what is considered a standard in the industry.
Yes,
I don't think that layer grouping is going to be something that is purely a Photoshop thing and GIMP is stealing it and they're trying to be photo. Come on, guys.
No, this is
a graphic UI concept. This is small potatoes.
No, that's very true.
I mean, I would have more complaints with the way that the UI does actually get presented on some platforms, with all the toolboxes showing up as independent windows. They are working on that in GIMP, and it's gotten better in GIMP 6. It's gotten a lot better in GIMP 6, but still.
The single window design, and I think, I'm not sure if the most recent version of GIMP does, or that the development version no longer has the menu in OS X, has the menu in the window in OS X. I mean, that was bad.
That's true. That is actually a big UI concern for OS X.
Anyway, isn't this really the problem here, that Ubuntu is dropping GIMP? Isn't this really up to FSpot to solve?
Well, that depends. If FSpot's supposed to actually be the chosen successor, there is some mention of FSpot getting editor plugins and actually handling it that way, and I'd like to see what they could do. Right now, I'm not aware of any other serious competitor that's, again, not backed by some large corporation.
I can't think now.
I think we finished that topic.
Okay. I'm just not looking forward to the comments I'm going to get. You know, I've had a really horrible day yesterday and a really hard week, and I'm just like, rah, 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 hate, 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 hate.
It doesn't show. You hide it so
should,
well.
Maybe we should say, everyone please be nice to Croc for a while. He's had a hard
nice.
Week.
I like to be educated. Correct me, please. But just, you know, I'm just getting rah, rah, rah angry at everything because I'm like that when it comes to UI. Because I can't see the reason for it. If something's wrong, I want to fix it.
The point would be you'll write your own programs if it's necessary.
I do in a lot of instances, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know.
I wrote my own text editor, and because there was nothing on Windows that was good enough, and I used that text editor until I switched to Mac OS X and I found TextMate. There was nothing on Windows at all that existed that was as good as my own text editor for my own purposes and the way I code. Thankfully, now something has turned up. I think there's a text editor called Sublime Text, which is on Windows, which looks really nice. But basically, that's the that took to this year before there was a text editor that existed that I would consider using. So I'm like that. I can't program everything, but I have very, very high standards as to what I expect for UI and especially user experience.
I guess the biggest concern I have is, does it run on multiple platforms? Because if it doesn't, it's no good to me.
Interesting. See, now generally...
Oh, on that point, actually,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm just picking up on what Tess has said. There's one thing that I would like to quickly grab for a 5-minute chat. Microsoft on Silverlight versus Standards from your own Tom Howard.
Yes.
Sorry, that's just hilarious. I love this. There's one quote that I've just reread. Unfortunately, Mac offers no support for COM interfaces, and we're actively evaluating options to get COM-like features on the Mac. That's just... no. It's not a good idea. We need to just go with the open standards.
Hello,
but,
security flaws. Just
doing
anything on the Mac. COM.
Could go wrong.
Yeah. What's the worst that could happen?
It's that same kind of idea. Why not just use something that works on all platforms? There's open standards that work on all platforms, and yet we've still got people desperately trying to force their own individual ideas. Flash is much, much worse than Silverlight in that respect, but the fact that Microsoft is going, oh yeah, Flash is a good business model, we'll follow that, pains me.
How long will any of these technologies last in light of some of the things that are coming out of the HTML5 standard?
How much money do these companies
long.
Have?
Hopefully not long. Yes, I'm banking on that too.
HTML5 will eventually replace these things because of things like what Google Chrome OS is doing by pushing the web forward and solving these integration problems. However, Flash and Silverlight are not going to go away as long as Microsoft and Adobe have money to throw at the problem. I mean, if you've seen the stuff about Adobe's open government, that's just hilarity ensues.
Ooh, I have not. Give me a quick breakdown.
Oh, gosh. Adobe are trying to push the government to use Flash technologies. And they created a website about this. And the website was obviously in Flash. And it was inaccessible. And you couldn't change the text size. And there were so many problems with it that highlighted the exact flaws of why Flash isn't open, that it was almost like the most perfect piece of satire if it were not.
Yeah, okay. Nope, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So these companies are just going to solve these problems by throwing money at it, like Adobe and Microsoft. They're going to throw lobbying and money at these problems to try and solve it. HTML5, however, as long as developers are educated enough, will eventually negate the need for these sorts of things. I'm hoping anyway, because they are simply better ways of doing things. They might not be as flash and as fancy, but at the end of the day, I just want to view a bloody video. Stop with
I think you're in the minority, though. I mean, you look at the number. Look at the number of sites and companies who... Even now, with the proliferation of handheld devices that aren't necessarily going to carry Flash, and Flash is so painful to use on a handheld device, and yet companies still have the entire web page as nothing but Flash. And if you're going to have large companies where you can't go to their web page on anything but a full-scale laptop or desktop PC with Flash installed, that's a hell of a hurdle to jump over. I think it's going to take a lot of years before
people find it. But isn't the iPhone doing that, really? I mean, I've got a lot of complaints about the iPhone, but I have to applaud Apple for not putting Flash on it and, you know, totally avoiding that as well, because it is forcing companies to do things properly with HTML and the standards.
Well, I thought it was already a well-known web developer bad smell, as it were, to borrow the term from the refactoring study from development, that if your entire web page is Flash, this is a bad thing.
Some will never learn.
But create.
I think that it's gotten better. I think that the age of all Flash websites has actually kind of started to pass.
Yeah.
I think that people have kind of woken up that that was not such a smart thing to do.
Stating it lightly, yeah.
Yeah, I'm coming across those a lot less and less now of just because I don't have Flash installed. I basically just see a completely blank page, and I'm coming across those less and less now, thankfully.
But I think that you've also got the fact that it's made so easy and it's bundled into a lot of the creative professional world. A lot of people who aren't web developers but love the creativity that Flash gives them. And I think that if you're going to get any bashing, it's probably going to be that group, the group that likes to be able to do all these fancy things. And they've made it very easy for the person creating the content. They've just made it a pain in the butt for the end user.
Yeah, we shouldn't blame the actual creative individual. We should blame, A, their education, i.e. what school or college taught them, because they just handed them Dreamweaver or some rubbish like that. These people just want to create nice-looking things, right? And the standards aren't able to... There isn't a tool out there that basically works exactly the same as Flash Studio, but just outputs SVG or whatever. That's the difficulty with the standards, is that you've just got to learn the hard way to do it. And I'm hoping someday somebody builds a sort of a Flash Studio, but just does it all in standards, and then we might see, you know, the death of Flash or something like that.
I agree. It's going to be a long wait.
Oh yeah, definitely. Should we move on to this thing about should smoking void warranties? Our top story at the moment.
Yay!
Because this is fun.
Yeah. We're getting close to the whole hour or two. Yeah. So
this story is about that Apple is refusing to repair machines still under Apple Care from customers who smoke, citing health risks from secondhand smoke.
That's stupid. Only insofar as it's stupid to say it's a health risk from second-hand smoke. I presume that when the desktop computer gets to the Apple Repair Center, it does not open like something out of a Stanley Kubrick movie. I'm imagining that the smoke has deposited by this point. So that's stupid. But I do agree that it should void your warranty in the same way as dumping 2 tons of Cheeto dust into your machine should void your warranty. It is something outside of Apple's control, which you could have prevented. So I'm actually for the idea of saying, yeah, smoke, it's your own problem. I'm going to get flamed.
No, because, I mean, it's a hot topic because the people agree and disagree. Now, I should say that both me and William have fixed computers quite often. I do it as a full-time job. And I've come across a couple of computers that have literally died from smoking. The hard drive crashed, the CPU, the fins on the heatsink were just completely clogged, the fan was clogged, and the machine just killed itself. And you get a deposit of tar, the smell is absolutely awful, and you just cannot get rid of the smell no matter what. It stains the plastic, everything. It just does incredibly nasty things to the insides of computers. Now, the problem is that dust can also do that as well. Just plain household dust, if it builds up to a certain amount, can conduct electricity and therefore could short a machine out. Smoking is just a particularly unpleasant way of doing of shorting a machine out, but I'm not sure you could really argue that just a dust build-up could void the warranty.
But then you're arguing two different points. On the one side, you're saying smoking, should it void the warranty? I mean, the person's building up the smoke, but dust could also build up. Yeah, dust is predominantly human skin. I'm not going to shed my skin
to preserve my computer, I might consider not smoking in front of it. But this is just a classic argument. Do smokers need to be given kid gloves, or are they big enough and mature enough to know that what they're doing to themselves is also going to affect the things around them? I mean, the ceilings, walls, all these kind of things get horribly stained by smoking, to the point where a lot of people who rent properties in the UK and presumably other places will say, no, we don't want you, you're a smoker, you're going to make the place look horrid.
Yes,
is that
yes.
Same kind of discrimination?
Yeah, even here in Minnesota, we do have certain apartment renters which actually will have completely no smoking policies inside the building. You can smoke, you know, on your balcony, but that's about it.
It's also part of Lean fire regs as well, so there's an actual insurance side to that as well, that if you have a smoker in your premises, it's actually a fire risk, and therefore you have a load of extra obligations that you have to deal with.
The problem with this is that there are some very good reasons to actually void warranties for users who smoke. It does come across as a bit of demonization for something which is not technically illegal, at least in the U.S.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing, is because as much as people hate smoking,
I mean, how does this jive with the term discrimination? I mean.
Yeah.
There's a good reason, yes, but you could also ban people who excessively shed their skin for the same logic. I mean, where
you have keratosis, I'm afraid you're not allowed to. Yeah.
The thing that the argument that I keep seeing for why this is not so much because the cause of that additional damage to the system. I think that's not nearly as much of a concern. The concern that comes to my mind is that there have been some studies in the last 2 years which suggest that there's something called third-hand smoke, which the smoke that is gets permeated into materials and can be transmitted long after the actual smoking act. And the concern that immediately springs to mind with that is, well, what about the people who are repairing these systems? And if they repair them in California, now you have additional concerns about health risks you're causing to repair facility personnel, which are doing this by hand. Do you really want to include the additional health care expense that might come with that? Now, whether or not this actually stands to any more recent studies, I have not looked into, so I immediately concede that point. But this is the angle I'm beginning to think that is going along with their side of it, that it increases their costs on the repair end, not for the hardware, but for the personnel doing the repair.
Another factor is also that perhaps what we can see from this is that Apple can't refurb such machines and parts, etc., because of the damage and stains caused to them by smoking. So Apple refurb a lot of stuff, and they reuse everything they can get their hands on. Even when you're purchasing new computers, they could be using refurb parts.
Remanufacture.
Not refurbished. We should use the correct legal terms. so you've got right there. That could be Apple obviously just trying to reduce their overheads and things like that. But again, since smoking isn't actually illegal, therefore you have to argue on perhaps a health risk. Now, a dusty machine isn't going to perhaps present an actual health risk to a technician, but the tar.
Well, don't exactly say that either. With asthmatic conditions, that would be a serious serious consideration.
I have to warn people out of the room before I clear out their CPU. Sorry, your power supply unit needs to be cleared. Are you asthmatic? Please leave the room. And I do it in all seriousness because I gag on it half of the time. But you've got a very good point. And for anybody who says that OS News does not do enough research, I think Tess has just disproven that once and for all with that wonderful, wonderful little tirade about the third-hand smoke thing. I don't know where you managed to find that, but wow, plus 10 points to Tess.
This is what happens when you grow up in Minnesota and you listen to Minnesota Public Radio. I'm sorry.
Fair enough. The whole issue of discrimination.
No, that was not an ad. I'm not as sponsored by them in any way.
The The
fair enough. Keep...
idea that it could be down to discrimination, though, is an extremely slippery slope, because as we know, that can just lead on to anything. I mean, not most of all, recent news in the UK about the possibility of law to come in for discrimination against obese people. So-called fatism.
Well, keeping it topical to the smoking thing, I just think we've gotten past the point where people expect to be treated with kid's gloves when it comes to smoking. I think the biggest concern I have with the idea of Apple getting a lovely blank check against all smokers is when the problem is clearly not to do with smoke. And when you send off something to AppleCare, the technician opens up the box and goes, "Oh, smoker, excellent. I can box that back up and send it straight back to the guy. It doesn't cost us a penny."
Yeah, it's like a cheap cop-out.
Right,
I
mean, this policy isn't even applied universally either. Even within the U.S. News article, it says that there are other individuals who have had perfectly fine service, and they were smokers.
But the thing is that the smoke can, like dust as well, really, confuse the issue. If you've got a CD drive or a hard drive that's failing, you don't know the history of the computer, so what environmental factors may have caused that. Is it a mechanical failure on the hard drive's part, or was it the smoking that did that? The smoking is certainly going to add to it, but is it the straw that broke the camel's back?
It's actually in the linked article of off of the OS News article. So that was my mistake.
No, sorry. Yeah, there's so many... as a business doing this, as Apple as a business, then it's obviously there's a lot of legal and insurance questions about this that they wouldn't want void and nullified because of the issues of that, and just trying to save a buck as well when to be able to deny people service if they believe that they caused the problem themselves. I don't really understand, though, to what extent is this a problem in the US? Are they getting a lot of machines like this?
It's hard to know. We don't have any hard numbers on this, so we would have to infer, and you know, inferences are colored by one's local memeplex, as it were. So I don't think that's necessarily something we should speculate too hard upon without any real evidence to back it up.
I'd say there's no greater concern with any one geographical region, but the idea that smoking could be the cause of the computer failing, yeah, as are many other things. But I'm slightly... possibly naive in this respect, but I'm slightly more willing to trust Apple when they say we might void it based on this, considering I am currently on my third iPhone 3GS in 3 months. hoping beyond hope that Apple is not listening to this podcast, I had a Belkin car dock, and randomly my iPhone died in it. Now, being the smart individual that I am, I decided to blame the iPhone, then put my new iPhone in that Belkin car dock, now found its way to the bin. So having had my iPhone replaced twice by the Apple Genius Bar, without a question, without a qualm, I have a lot of faith in when they say, we're only going to be doing this for, you know, health risk reasons. I don't imagine that they are going to be doing this worst case scenario. But the question is, how naive of me is that? Is it simply arrogant to imagine that your company, your glorious Apple, aren't going to ever abuse this?
It's true that they might not ever, they may very well abuse it, but we have to speak relatively, because obviously Apple are rated as one of the best companies for support. Nothing's perfect, but they're better than other companies have. I'm on my fourth MacBook Pro as we speak already. So...
One non-Apple user in the conversation right now, I keep wondering, wow, how many of your systems have died from this manufacturer?
Yeah.
I mean, I've never had a problem with some of my stuff.
To be fair, when I've had Apple Macs that lasted forever, I've had a lot of Mac hardware that just won't die, even when I've got a really good insurance policy on it, a brand new one. Blasted iPod. But the iPhone itself hasn't had a problem. It's just been me and the way I used it. I dumped it into a dock that was probably sending through a few too many amps every now and again and randomly frying the battery.
I would blame Apple's proprietary docking standard instead of applying to something more open like micro USB. I mean,
no, I'll agree with that.
That's a completely different argument, though.
No, I agree with Tess's point. The sooner they get rid of that stupid dock connector, the better. But considering...
They might have to in the EU. I thought the Mobile Phone Consortium actually voted to make micro USB the standard.
That was decided for smartphones. It won't be coming in until late 2011. And whilst Apple did agree to that, obviously it's still a long time frame, and we don't know in what format they agreed to it. They may very well just create a dock connector, which then has a micro USB in the other side, so the dock connector is basically an adapter. They could cop out like that.
Or put both on the iPhone, somehow wish to shoot on a micro USB in there for people who so wish, which would be stupid
as
well.
It's backwards compatibility, though, with so many cars and devices and so forth now with dock compatibility. It's not going to go away. All I can see is that they're just going to create a dock connector which has a mini USB in the other end so that you can just adapt, so that it's just basically an adapter. Because if you buy any power supply for any phone that uses a micro USB, then all you need to do is plug the dock connector in and then put that into the micro USB. Seems like the cheapest solution, really.
Also available from Belkin, Griffin, and every other third-party app map. You just know it's going to be... It's already out there to a certain degree. I used to have a dock connected to USB adapter because I frankly couldn't be bothered to carry around a USB cable.
Back in my day, we had flipping FireWire going straight into the wall plug. That was the good old days. None of this bloody dock connector stuff. FireWire.
Oh dear, showing your age.
iPod 3G. I got an iPod 3G in December 2003. Just as they were moving over to Windows, it was an iTunes came out. I think earlier that month or just the month before. And yeah, I paid £400 for a 40 gigabyte iPod 3G at the time, and they were interested. It was an awesome device. I got my money's worth out of it. It was the most expensive thing MP3 player you could buy, period, at the time. And 40 gig, it was excellent storage. But also, you got everything in the box. There were no accessories. It all came in the box. You got a hardcover sleeve. You've got the full dock. You've got the power plug for it, and a wipe for it, and just everything all came in the box. And you got your money's worth. Oh, and you also got the cool remote control for it thingy, you know, on a cable. It had the play buttons and everything like that. So I would clip that to my sleeve and then have it run up into my inside pocket in my coat.
Yeah, I mean, again, slightly off topic from the whole smoking thing.
Yes.
I agree that Apple aren't likely to use this as a get-out clause, but I do think there should be concerns about whether or not they will use this as a get-out clause and as a way of being prejudiced towards smokers. But I also think that it is a valid argument to say that smoke can cause detriment to your computer that just can't be considered part of the warranty. They're not going to start making laptops smoke-proof, so it has to be taken into account in the same way as accidentally dropping your laptop into water, except you've done this as a conscious choice.
Yeah.
That's why I started out, is I think I agree with them on that respect.
Same here, really. It's just obviously the finer details of it as to how Apple are going to actually enforce that, you know, their commitment there.
That is a worry.
And also, we don't know if there's any government guidelines actually on this, because obviously a warranty is a legal thing. Your first year is your legal warranty. Now, that's defined by law, but I don't know. I doubt the law actually stipulates, obviously, details like smoking, etc. Obviously, having to come up with Apple. So if it's wrong, it would have to be questioned in court, really, to uphold whether that is part of warranty or not.
Have you got any little eagles in the listener base? Please feel free to comment on that part, because I'd like to know as well. As far as I'm concerned, the warranty idea being something legal that's enforced by the government seems mute, considering that all the manufacturers just write their own little clause into what counts as a warranty. Great, thanks.
Yeah, the law is so generalized that obviously the companies will say pretty much anything as far as what they consider to be warranty. And I have no idea how that operates in the US. So our own warranty here in the UK is different.
Yeah, I really can't speak to much of that either, because my personal stance on most warranties is that I never trust that they'll actually ever be fulfilled in any circumstance.
You expect them to loophole, don't you? You just go, no, it's not going to be covered by the warranty. No, I mean, the screen exploded and the battery came out and ejected acid all over my legs, but it won't be counted under the warranty, it's fine. And that's why I tend to have insurance policies for these things, and I don't think I've ever used a warranty on a product.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally because most of the time
my logic always tended to be more so that by the time that the device should fail, I'll probably be wanting a newer one anyway.
Yeah.
So why should I give them their protection money for something I'm going to just replace sooner rather than later?
Well,
anyway,
that said, actually, I do have an AppleCare for my laptop, and I actually highly recommend that if you're buying an Apple laptop, do get AppleCare. Look on eBay; you can usually get it cheaper, even shrink wrapped. Because my last repair for my laptop would have cost me £1,000, and I didn't have to pay that.
And please do buy that, because for each purchase, Croc gets £1.
The advertisement. No, you don't want to pay Apple's repair charges. You really, really don't.
Oh. I once asked them about a really old, my iPod 160GB. That's right, I got there when they were still doing that one. But the 160GB iPod Classic. And they said, oh, if you want to do repairs on that, you'd want to buy a new iPod. And they were giving me repair prices that were more expensive than the new line. You're like, okay, fine, given up. That's just how they work. But I think that's more a case of them inflating the price. Oh, that's the other one, iBook. iBook G4 screen replacement, £400. I replaced that for, I think it cost me £40 to get the screen, and then I had it replaced, done.
Yeah.
And that's just, £400 is ridiculous. I think they're just trying to, as Tess said, push you onto the new hardware. Why would you want to carry on using that old one when a shiny new one would be the same price?
I think we should wrap this up. Mm-hmm. That covers time and topics. Thank you very much, Tess, for joining us, and of course also thank you, William, for joining us today. I apologise, everybody, if the podcast has been a bit sort of slow and sort of jaunty. Is that we've had some lag and it's difficult, and William, you're new to the experience. I don't think our list of topics are particularly fantastic, and I'm on a what do you call it? I'm on a pillaging mood. I am
carrying the pitchfork and torch in both hands. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's finish off. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And any questions you've got, well, any feedback you've got about the podcast, you can comment on the website osnews.com when it gets published there, or you can send us an email at crew@osnews.com. You can't contact me on Twitter. I actually deleted my account. I had enough of that. But you can email me. You may as well use the OS News address, because that will get through to me anyway. And Tess, how can people get hold of you?
You can find me at denonet.org. Also, I actually have a OS News account now, so you can find me at tess@osnews.com, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, nice, I didn't even know that. Okay. And, William,
and I am a shady, ethereal concept that doesn't truly exist. An amalgamated AI, if you will. You can contact me by simply broadcasting into Google and hoping for the best.
I thought you'd say that. I'm just a concept.
It's an abstract, if you will.
Okay.
Better.
Thank you, everybody. Hopefully we can do this again next week.
Oh, definitely.